dance on the air. We're here cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
And welcome to Dads on the Air for the 22nd of September 2009. We have a great show ahead of us today, 90 minutes of riveting information in regards to separation, men's topics and men's groups. We have on today's show Iron John, which is a story about men, narrated by American Robert Bly, who is an author and poet. We'll also be talking with two guys who have opened up a men's group in Sydney around, I guess, the theories and stuff around Iron John. So it'll be an interesting story and well worth waiting for. First of all, in the studio today, we have Ian Purdy from IanPurdy.com.
Good morning, Phil.
How are you?
Yeah, very well, mate.
That's good, mate. Welcome. And strapped into the seat next to me, we have Bill.
Good morning, Phil. Good morning, Ian. And it's great to be with everyone on a beautiful day like today.
It is, absolutely, mate. There's a bit of dust blowing in from the south, though. I was coming up and a bit of a dust storm around home, and apparently it's heading up towards Sydney. So anyone that's got any asthma problems or stuff, probably better off staying inside later on this afternoon when the wind hits. From the news, from the Australian on the 18th of September, by Caroline Ovington, boy three has alternate months in Dubai. Three-year-old has been living in Dubai, 1 month in Sydney and back again in a roundabout arrangement because his parents cannot come to an agreement on custody. Shocking stuff. The family court admits the deal is far from ideal. The flying time is 15 hours and the child has been making a trip monthly since December, but neither parent has been willing to concede in the long legal battle over their son. Turns out in March 2007, the mother took the child to Dubai to live with the court's permission. It was to be for an 18-month period so the mother could take up a contract. The father, 41, did not immediately object because the mother told him he would be able to visit. It turns out that in the ensuing 18 months or so, this child has ended up having to take a plane trip, 14 to 15 hours duration, just so he can be able to see mum and dad. It's before the court again. There is an appeal. Mum has refused to move back at this stage, and you know the only one that pays from this is little three-year-old boy.
Yeah, poor little fella being dragged, you know, from Dubai to Australia, straddling two continents.
Yeah,
can't be that comfortable for him at all.
Can't be. Bill, what have you got for us?
Well, there's been an article, a leader, in fact, in the Moonee Valley Gazette on September the 14th of this year, in which a Dr. Gregory claims that the pay gap between the genders leads to poor health and well-being for women. The article is headed Pay Status and Extra Danger. It's been pointed out that that we'd like to hear some explanation for this claim, because on every indicator of health and well-being, mortality, morbidity, life expectancy, burden of disease, you'll find that men fare much worse across the board than do women. I guess the point that Dr. Gregory is missing is that women choose work that is safer, less time-consuming, involves less travel, and fits in with their families, and lives better than lives better than the work men choose. I guess this fits in with the general characterization of men being risk takers and the women not so. So I think there must be a query about this conclusion that's been reached by the Moonee Valley leader. Yes, these choices mean that they get paid less than men on average, but they also lead to women having much better health and well-being than men. It's well accepted that they have a longer life expectancy. And so I think it just leads us to query that conclusion that the gender gap is leading to this poor health and well-being.
Okay, fair enough. Staying on the subject of women, I've got an article here in this morning's Sydney Morning Herald. Kirsty Needham has written under the heading, Maternity Leave Can Still Lead to Sacking. She writes, women are being sacked for taking maternity leave and told to quit if they cannot juggle family and the work roster. The Fair Work Ombudsman officers found the Ombudsman was given the power to investigate discrimination for the first time in July and is already receiving 30 complaints a week and investigating 40 serious cases. The Ombudsman Chief's Counsel, Natalie James, said she was concerned at the number of women losing their jobs for taking maternity leave. That sounds like the situation with women in the workforce is still problematic, and this just tends to probably impact on children spending more time in daycare centres and less time with their mother, which is obviously not a good outcome.
Yeah,
it'd be interesting to find out on the question of really it's a family leave rather than maternity leave, but I wonder if men take the advantage of taking leave when they have children born, and whether they tend to stay hard at work. Be interesting to follow up on that side of it.
Yeah, well, obviously, more men stay. I mean, they don't have to go to hospital and they don't have the physical ramifications of birth, but, of course, there are immense emotional ramifications and financial ramifications, as we all know. The financial ramifications tend to keep men at the grindstone.
And another story here by the one and only Caroline Ovington from The Australian, dated 21st of September. Children must see dad, like it or not, from the family court. The family court has warned separated parents that they are required to hand over children for access visits, whether the children want to go or not. While the parents don't have to physically drag the children to the other parent, they do have to positively encourage them to go and punish those who refuse. The vexed issue of how far a parent must go to ensure that children see the other parent came before the court in a particular case where the father implored the court to do something to ensure that the children turned up for access visits. This, I guess, comes right on the head of child alienation. There can be certain things that some parents can do to discourage their children from seeing the other parent. And on the flip side of that, a little bit of encouragement, you want the best for your kids. You don't want to see them upset, sure, but I think sometimes half of the situation that happens when a child gets upset can be directly responsible from the parent. Well, you don't have to go, darling. Blah 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 blah, and then all of a sudden the kid basically gets permission from that parent that it's okay not to see the other parent. So of course they're going to go with it,
Yeah, and of course in cases of blatant parental alienation syndrome, one of the parents is telling the child that the other parent is no good and doesn't love them, and is feeding them poison. And I guess this is the kind of situation that the court is attempting to avoid.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah. So Caroline Ovington writes this article in such a way that it looks like these poor children are being dragged kicking and screaming and to an abusive father. Well, no, that's not the case at all. And the court is trying to just rectify, as Ian said, that problem where one parent is going against the other. The whole thing is that the children do have a right to both parents, and they need to be encouraged to see both parents, unless, of course, there is some sort of documented history of abuse or, neglect or whatever. But if that's not there and it's just, a tit-for-tat fight between mum and dad, who gets hurt? The children.
Yes, parental alienation is a big topic, which I think we'd like to explore in another program. And the other point is we don't want to get caught up in whether it's a syndrome or not. It's, if we can just say, parental alienation, I think everyone knows what we're talking about. But it can be done very subtly and discreetly. I mean, I've heard the description of one parent standing with hands on hips. That might be enough body language to indicate to the child that that parent is not fully supporting the child going to the other parent. And it's those subtle indications that are the hardest ones to fight.
Yep, and it turns into a loyalty game, doesn't it? I don't want to hurt mum, or I don't want to hurt dad, and it's just an awful situation to be in.
Yeah, well, if people want to dive into the archives, we did actually interview Dr. Ludwig Lowenstein last year, who wrote the book Parental Alienation Syndrome, which is the definitive book on the condition. And we did talk to him. So if you are interested in that subject, we do have a program on it.
Excellent. And, you know, there's lots of really good programs in our archives, and you can find that on dadsontheair.net. Just one last story. Mistresses entitled to family fortune. This came across the airwaves yesterday. Mistresses and love children will soon be entitled to a share of the family fortune unless there is a will in place specifically ruling them out. Controversial new intestacy laws will take effect in New South Wales early next year. Introduce the concept of multiple spouses to increase provision for de facto relationships, the Daily Telegraph says. The term domestic partner has been created to accommodate the new laws and includes a person in a de facto relationship with the deceased for 2 years more, of course, yes. Or if less than 2 years, one that has resulted in the birth of a child. So that's new laws coming into New South Wales early next year.
Yeah, undermining marriage even more, I would imagine, and also adding to splitting up families' wealth, you know, spreading it out amongst mistresses and, you know, I mean, it's probably good for illegitimate children that they should be looked after, but, I mean, I don't see it as a good thing.
The only people that win are the lawyers and the DNA companies, mate.
Yeah, absolutely.
This legislation is going to be a minefield because you can imagine the situations where there are a number of mistresses, and then you get down to what does actually constitute someone in that sort of in that relationship, and the legislation only makes it more complicated.
Absolutely.
So that's going to be very interesting.
Which, of course, just keeps everyone in court just that little bit longer while the arguments happen. Yep.
All right, well, we'll be back after this track. We'll be back with a reading from Robert Bly from his book Iron John, so stay tuned for that.
I was right, now I'm left to erase. And you know for a fact that I'm too proud to chase. So I head home and touch base. It's over for good, I ain't trying to make grace. I'm trying to get back in the race. Pick up some pace, call up the boys, pick up a case. Situations like this, that's how I feel. And you're probably telling your friends that I don't feel. But that could not be further from the truth. Yo, I feel a lot of things when I'm further from the booth. Heaven last week when I seen you in the street. And you looked at your feet and pretend you didn't see me. You turned your back and walked the other way. Yeah, cause I'm going to be okay.
I'm trying to stay the same. Leave me that you want me to be okay. I won't change. Let it all change things, cause I'm not playing. I'm trying to stay the same. With or without you, I'm gonna be okay. I won't change. Let it all change things, cause I'm going to be okay.
Times does it take before I can make up from where I'm falling? Am I blind in this day and age? Where am I going in this game? How many levels do I have to climb to find out how I'm playing? I'm desperate at times, my fault, but Hussein. I'm struggling at times, but you won't know what I'm saying. I'll keep it in mind, just let me know when I'm blamed. Cause I'm going to be okay. Yeah, looking back, what have I done? Some stupid decisions have been made, but looking back, it was fun. I got regrets, but I speak for myself. But I know I never change what I've done. Where I've gone, where I've been, where I'm at. Cause some standards are tall. Where I'm going, where it's at. It's a knock at the door. Now when I turn my back and look the other way, I know that I am going to be okay.
I'm trying to stay the same. When you're without you, I won't be okay. I won't change. Let it all change things. Cause I'm not playing. I'm trying to stay the same. When you're without you, I'm gonna be okay. I won't change. Let it all change things. Cause I'm going to be okay.
with Dad's on the air.
We are living at an important and fruitful moment now. For it is clear to men that the images of adult manhood given by the popular culture are worn out. A man can no longer depend on them. By the time a man is 35, he knows that the images of the right man, the tough man, the true man, which he received in high school, do not work in life. Such a man is open to visions of what a man is or could be. The hearth and fairy stories have passed as water through 50 feet of soil, through generations of men and women, and we can trust their images more than, say, those invented by Hans Christian Andersen. The images the old stories give, stealing the key from under the mother's pillow, picking up a golden feather fallen from the burning breast of the firebird, finding the wild man under the lake water, following the tracks of one's own wound through the forest and finding that it resembles the tracks of a god, these are meant to be taken slowly into the body. They continue to unfold once taken in. It is in the old myths that we hear, for example, of Zeus energy, that positive leadership energy in men, which popular culture constantly declares does not exist. From King Arthur, we learn the value of the male mentor in the lives of young men. We hear from the Iron John story the importance of moving from the mother's realm to the father's realm. And from all initiation stories, we learn how essential it is to leave our parental expectations entirely and find a second father or a second king. There is male initiation, female initiation, and human initiation. In the following text, I will be talking about male initiation only. I want to make clear that this work does not seek to turn men against women, nor to return men to the domineering mode that has led to repression of women and their values for centuries. The thought in this work does not constitute a challenge to the women's movement. The two movements are related to each other, but each moves on a separate timetable. The grief in men has been increasing steadily since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and the grief has reached a depth now that cannot be ignored. The dark side of men is clear. Their mad exploitation of earth resources, devaluation and humiliation of women, obsession with tribal warfare are undeniable. Genetic inheritance contributes to their obsessions, but also culture and environment. We have defective mythologies that ignore masculine depth of feeling, assign men a place in the sky instead of earth, teach obedience to the wrong powers, work to keep men boys, and entangle both men and women in systems of industrial domination that exclude both matriarchy and patriarchy. I speak of the wild man on this tape, and the distinction between the savage man and the wild man is crucial throughout. The savage mode does great damage to soul, earth, and humankind. We can say that though the savage is wounded, he prefers not to examine it. The wild man, who has examined his wound, resembles a Zen priest or a shaman or a woodsman more than a savage. The knowledge of how to build a nest in a bare tree, how to fly to the wintering place, how to perform the mating dance, all of this information is stored in a bird in the reservoirs of its instinctual brain. But human beings, sensing how much flexibility they might need in meeting new situations, decided to store this sort of knowledge outside the instinctual systems. And they stored it in fairy stories. Stories, then, fairy stories, legends, myths, hearth stories, amount to a reservoir where we keep new ways of responding that we can adopt when the conventional and current ways wear out. And we talk a great deal about the American man, as if there were some constant quality that remains stable over decades or even within a single decade. The men who live today have veered far away from the Saturnian, old-man-minded farmer, proud of his introversion, who arrived in New England in 1630, willing to sit through three services in an unheated church. In the South, an expansive, mother-bound cavalier developed, and neither of these two American men resembled the greedy railroad entrepreneur that later developed in the Northeast, nor the reckless I-will-do-without-culture settlers of the West. Even in our own era, the agreed-on model has changed dramatically. During the 50s, for an example, an American character appeared with some consistency that became a model of manhood adopted by many men, namely the 50s male. He got to work early, labored responsibly, supported his wife and children, and admired discipline. Reagan is a sort of mummified version of this dogged type. This sort of man didn't see women's souls well, but he appreciated their bodies. And his view of culture and America's part in it was boyish and optimistic. Many of his qualities were strong and positive, but underneath the charm and bluff, there was, and still remains, much isolation, deprivation, and passivity. Unless he has an enemy, he isn't sure that he's alive. During the 60s, another sort of man appeared. The waste and violence of the Vietnam War made men question whether they knew what an adult male really was. If manhood meant Vietnam, did they want any part of it? Meanwhile, the feminist movement encouraged men to actually look at women, forcing them to become conscious of concerns and sufferings that the 50s male labored to avoid. As men began to examine women's history and women's sensibilities, some men began to notice what was called their feminine side and to pay attention to it. This process continues to this day, and I would say that most contemporary men are involved in it in some way. There's something wonderful about this development. I mean, the practice of men welcoming their own feminine consciousness and nurturing it. This is important. And yet I have the sense that there is something wrong. The male in the past 20 years has become more thoughtful and more gentle, but by this process he has not become more free. In the 70s, I began to see all over the country a phenomenon that we might call the soft male. Sometimes even today, when I look out in an audience, perhaps half the young males are what I'd call soft. They're lovely, valuable people. I like them. They're not interested in harming the earth or starting wars. There's a gentle attitude toward life and their whole being and style of living. But many of these men are not happy. You quickly notice the lack of energy in them. They are life-preserving, but not exactly life-giving. Ironically, you often see these men with strong women who positively radiate energy. I first learned about the anguish of so-called soft men when they told their stories in early men's gatherings. In 1980, the Lama community in New Mexico asked me to teach a conference for men only, their first, in which about 40 men participated. Each day we concentrated on one Greek god and one old story, and then late in the afternoons we gathered to talk. When the younger men spoke, it was not uncommon for them to be weeping within 5 minutes. The amount of grief and anguish in these younger men was astounding to me. Part of their grief rose out of remoteness from their fathers, which they felt keenly, but partly, too, grief flowed from trouble in their marriages or relationships. They had learned to be receptive, but receptivity wasn't enough to carry their marriages through troubled times. In every relationship, something fierce is needed once in a while. Both the man and the woman need to have it. But at the point when it was needed, often the young man came up short. He was nurturing, but something else was required for his relationship and for his life. The journey many American men have taken into softness or receptivity or, quote, development of the feminine side, unquote, has been an immensely valuable journey, but more travel lies ahead. No stage is the final stop. One of the fairy tales that speak of a third possibility for men, a third mode, is a story called Iron John or Iron Hans. Though it was first set down by the Grimm brothers around 1820, this story could be 10 or 20,000 years old. As the story starts, we find that something strange has been happening.
Okay, well, that was Robert Bly. We'll just leave that story there for a little minute. And on the line, we have Athel, who is a member of a men's group called Iron John. Good morning, Athel. Are you there?
Hey, Ian. How you going?
Yeah, very well, mate. Very well. Welcome to Dad's on the Air, and thanks for coming on the program.
Oh, my pleasure.
Would you like to just begin by telling us a little bit about your story, about how your life evolved to the point where you found that perhaps, you know, you found yourself being led to joining a men's group?
Sure. I guess to start it, I was very much through my mid to late teens and into my early 20s, quite rebellious, and like most kids, you know, was trying a few things and discovered that trying a few things turned into becoming dependent on a few things. And at the tender age of 23, I booked myself into a rehabilitation centre. And throughout the course of, I guess, you know, studying the internal workings of AFL, came to the conclusion that I actually needed something a little more than just not taking drugs to enhance my growth.
Would you mind just elaborating on what drugs you were taking?
Oh, sure. It was there was lots of marijuana smoking and speed use, and which definitely didn't. If you want a cocktail for paranoia and schizophrenia, that's certainly it. And
yes, absolutely.
So it left me, you know, I guess I was just trying to fill a hole that that was obvious was there for me, and I wasn't sure about how to fill it. Nobody had ever taught me what it was or how to fill it. You know, my relationship with my parents wasn't great, like most teenagers, I guess, and I don't think that they really had the tools on board to be able to nurture me through it. And I didn't have much in the way of, you know, Robert Bly was talking about mentorship. And it wasn't until my, you know, early 20s that any of that sort of turned up in my life. And I was mostly trying to work out how to be a man from the people that I was surrounded with. And that's what they were doing, so I figured that was the way to go.
Athel, it's Bill Cable here. Just wondering, was there any aggression in your response that when you were going through all this?
Plenty. I think probably aggression was my main state of being at the time, especially when you're using copious amounts of amphetamines and stuff. It certainly doesn't do much for your gentler side.
Okay, so and did you come from an intact family? Were your parents still together? So you came from, and you had brothers and sisters, presumably.
No, actually, I was an only child, so I think that didn't help. All the classic things that they talk about in psychology about family systems. There was nowhere to disseminate any of that stuff. It was all on me, and yeah, they were intact, but I've often wondered why they didn't seem to like each other very much. And I've always thought that perhaps, like in the circumstances, it probably would have been better for them to separate. It may have even been better for me as a child. Uh-huh. I don't know. You know, I guess, you know, like everybody, none of us get an instruction book, so we all kind of feel our way.
Sure, and we all like to think that the grass might have been greener on the other side of the fence if we'd been over there.
And from what I understand today from many of my friends who did have separated parents, that whether it was greener or not, it still needed to be mowed.
Yeah, sure. So you found yourself at the age of 23 basically in a state of crisis.
Yes, pretty much.
A drug addiction, and you booked yourself into rehab. Yep. What happened from there?
The place that I went to was... While there was women involved, the houses were always separate. It was always the men's house and the women's house, and I found that was quite cathartic and very. It opened my eyes to a few things. The fact that I was just around other men who were trying to fix their own lives helped immensely, because it meant that I didn't have to act anymore. I didn't have to pretend to be something that really at the time I didn't even know what I was, let alone pretending to be something else. You know, Robert Bly just talked about those stereotypes that we got from the 50s man, and you know, movies like lots of John Wayne movies and Robert Mitchum films, and
yep.
When I was growing up, so that was kind of like what I presumed men did, you know.
And, sure, the standard fare of television.
Pretty much. You know, being a television child, it was easy to get it, and you know, and a lot of the people that I was hanging around at the time were the same. You know, they were television kids, so they that's where they got their ideas of what men were about and what women were about too. So when I got out in the real world and found that women weren't all helpless and often didn't need me, it was kind of like, well, now what do I do?
Sure, trying to find a place. And yep. So, okay, so how long were you in rehab and what happened after that, basically?
I was there for 7 months.
Yep. Which is a long stint.
Well, yeah, at the time it was. I thought it was. There are rehabs that... I guess it had shortened by the time I got there. Originally, that particular rehabilitation centre was nearly a two-year program, so which was even longer. So I was glad that I got there at the time that I did, because it only meant 7 months away from life, I guess.
Sure.
And through that, I met a few people that were actually involved in men's issues groups at the time. I think at that time, we're talking 1990, it was kind of... The men's movement was pretty much in its infancy, and so I got together with a group of people that were actually involved in some of that, and started to look at some of the issues that had affected me. It predominantly started with looking at my issues in relationships and with women, and I had a few, I can certainly assure you. And then from there, it kind of, as I've grown over the last, 20 years or so, it's burgeoned into looking for the inner resources to deal with life and my place in society as a man. So, yeah, it's just been an ongoing process, and probably will be an ongoing process until the day I die.
Sure, but it never stops. So take us forward a bit. I mean, how did you first encounter the Iron John group?
I was actually at a men's retreat in where were we? Stanmore Park, and we were doing a few men's issues, and some of it was centred around Robert Bly and the story of Iron John, the therapist who was actually running that particular men's retreat. Had some experience around Iron John and the story of Iron John and with Robert Bly, so we started to listen to that, and I actually started to find that he made a lot of sense. There was things in it that I thought, yeah, I could actually take something from that. The story of the necessity to lose oneself before one can find oneself, that was the kind of message that I got in that. Which was, it pertained to me. I lost myself in my drug use, and then through a gradual process over years and years of, therapy and counselling and men's groups, started to actually find out who I was. And I kind of related to that stuff, the losing oneself and then finding oneself again. The necessity for complete self-abandonment in order to be an empty vessel to find out what would fill it up.
Sure.
I guess that was my first introduction to Iron John. And ever since then, it's kind of been, again, that gradual process of finding out who Athol is and running with it.
Okay, well, we might just go to a song, and then after that, I will play a little bit more, another extract from Robert Bly, and then we'll get you back on after that.
So sure, mate.
We'll speak to you in probably about 2 minutes' time.
No problem, man. Thank you.
Thanks, Athol.
The greatest feeling I ever felt. Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
As I've participated in men's gatherings since the early 1980s, I've heard one statement over and over from American men, which has been phrased in 100 different ways. There is not enough father. The sentence implies that father is a substance like salt, which in earlier times was occasionally in short supply, or like groundwater, which in some areas now has simply disappeared. Geoffrey Gore remarked in his book, The American People, that for a boy to become a man in the United States in 1940, only one thing was required, namely, that he reject his father. He noticed, moreover, that American fathers expect to be rejected. Young men in Europe, by contrast, have traditionally imagined the father to be a demonic being whom they must wrestle with. Many sons in the United States, however, visualize the father as a simple object of ridicule to be made fun of, as in fact he is so often in comic strips and television commercials. One young man summed it up, "A father is a person who rustles newspapers in the living room." Traditional cultures still in existence seem to have plenty of father. In so-called traditional cultures, many substitute fathers work with a young man. Uncles loosen the son up or tell him about women. Grandfathers give him stories. Warrior types teach weaponry and discipline. Old men teach ritual and soul. All of them honorary fathers. Fathers and sons in most tribal cultures live in an amused tolerance of each other. The son has a lot to learn, and so the father and son spend hours trying and failing together to make arrowheads or to repair a spear or track a clever animal. When a father and son do spend long hours together, which some fathers and sons still do, we could say that a substance almost like food passes from the older body to the younger. The contemporary mind might want to describe the exchange between father and son as a likening of attitude, a miming, but I think a physical exchange takes place, as if some substance was passing directly to the cells. The son's body, not his mind, receives, and the father gives, this food at a level far below consciousness. The son does not receive a hands-on healing, but a body-on healing. His cells receive some knowledge of what an adult masculine body is. The younger body learns at what frequency the masculine body vibrates. It begins to grasp the song that adult male cells sing, and how the charming, elegant, lonely, courageous, half-shamed male molecules dance. When a father absent during the day returns home at 6, his children receive only his temperament and not his teaching. If the father is working for a corporation, what is there to teach? He is reluctant to tell his son what is really going on. The fragmentation of decision-making in corporate life, the massive effort that produces the corporate willingness to destroy the environment for the sake of profit, the prudence, even cowardice, that one learns in bureaucracy, who wants to teach that? No historical models prepare us for the contemporary son's psychic condition. To understand the son's psyche, we have to imagine new furniture, new psychic figures, new demon possessions, new terrors, new incapacities, new flights. Enormous changes have appeared at the last minute. Few of us, fathers or sons, are prepared for such vast changes. I have mentioned so far the young men's father hunger and the starving bodies of the sons. We might look now at the disappearance of positive kings. The patriarchy is a complicated structure. Mythologically, it's matriarchal on the inside. And a matriarchy is equally complicated, being patriarchal on the inside. The political structure has to resemble our interior structure, and we know that each man has a woman inside him, and each woman has a man inside her. The genuine patriarchy brings down the son through the sacred king into every man and woman in the culture, and the genuine matriarchy brings down the moon through the sacred queen into every woman and every man in the culture. The death of the sacred king and queen means that we live now in a system of industrial domination, which is not patriarchy. The system we live in gives no honor to the male mode of feeling nor to the female mode of feeling. The system of industrial domination determines how things go with us in the world of resources, values, and allegiances, what animals live and what animals die, how children are treated, and in the mode of industrial domination, there is neither king nor queen. The death of the sacred king and the disappearance of the group king means that the father shortage becomes still more acute. When a father now sits down at the table, he seems weak and insignificant. And we all sense that fathers no longer fill as large a space in the room as 19th century fathers did. As the father seems more and more enfeebled, dejected, paltry, he also appears to be the tool of dark forces. We remember that in Star Wars, we are given an image of Darth Vader upon the dark father. He is wholeheartedly on the side of the dark forces. The demons who have set up a propaganda shop in the son's psyche convince him that his father's darkness is deeper than the son ever imagined. What can be done about that? The son finds out early that his mother cannot redeem his father. Moreover, in most cases, she doesn't want to. The only one left to do it is the son. As long as the political kings remained strong, the father picked up radiance from above, and the son tried to emulate the father, to become as bright as he is, to reach to his height. The son perceives the father as bright. Though this may not have been true in reality, we notice that literature as late as the 18th century is full of this sort of deference, this reverence for the father, and emulation. In our time, when the father shows up as an object of ridicule, as he does on television, or a fit field for suspicion, as he does in Star Wars, or a bad-tempered fool, when he comes home from the office with no teaching, or a weak puddle of indecision, as he stops inheriting kingly radiance, the son has a problem. How does he imagine his own life as a man? Some men fall into a secret despair. They have probably adopted, by the time they are six, their mother's view of their father, and by 20 will have accepted society's critical view of fathers, which amounts to a dismissal. What can they do but ask women for help?
And that was Robert Bly once again, and on the line we have Athol, who's going to be talking about the Iron John group. Hey there, Athol.
Good, mate.
Oh, I wonder if you could just tell us, I think you mentioned how you first were exposed to Iron John. I'm just wondering what attracted you into it and where you've gone with it from there.
Well, I guess what attracted me into it, Robert Bly then was just talking about the ridicule of the father and stuff. And, you know, you guys were talking earlier about, you know, hands on hips and children getting the impression that that one parent was bad or that they would upset one parent. And I found that a lot of the time my mother tended to do that. There was a great deal of ridiculing of my father, and the only way I could deal with that at the time was, I guess, to align myself with that. And as I've grown, I remember quite often through the 90s, there was a spate of, back to television again, programs that where younger men were trying to reconcile some of the differences, both externally and internally, with their fathers. And I found that Robert Bly's work and the story of Iron John gave me an opportunity to do some of that work, to be able to see my father differently, to understand that, you know, and to help me find a way to be a man in the world without necessarily, you know, being constantly aggressive and a danger to other people, to get a bit grounded and a bit more back to my natural state, I guess. You know, they talk at times now, there's people that tend to go to farmers markets, and the purpose of that is trying to eat food that's not covered in chemicals. It's also about trying to, how far away we are from our food. It's like, you know, we've got generations of children who think that lamb turns up in a freezer in a supermarket. I remember as a child being in the country and seeing that, you know, in order for me to eat, something else had to die. That sort of stuff, I think, needs to be taught. People need to understand that. It's not, you know, that things give their lives in order that we survive. And you know, there's a lot of a great deal of value in the acknowledgement of that, and the you know, there's a great deal of spirituality in the acknowledgement that something actually gave its life so that I could survive. And whether it's an animal or a vegetable, the reality is that something has to give its life in order for me to survive. You know, so there's a great many things that we actually, in the Western society that we live in, we're a long way away from. We're a long way away from, you know, and corporate America doesn't help. You know, it's what happened for me as a child, like, because I get that negative image of my father, I have to look for it somewhere else. So what I end up doing is that the corporation becomes my father. And then that doesn't fulfill my needs, so I go elsewhere to look for it. You know, sometimes it might be within Christianity, and then that doesn't fulfill me. So in the end, I end up walking around all my life unfulfilled and unhappy.
Yeah, looking for the father figure, looking for the sacred king.
Yes, that light that can actually show me how to do this, and that's what attracted me to Robert Bly. It wasn't just about, you know, here's the problem. It was like, I can actually give you some solutions to it.
Sure.
And I don't believe for a minute that he's any kind of demigod, that he has all the answers, but certainly it put me on a path where I could actually start looking for it. I could find some of those answers for myself.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about what actually takes place in the Iron John meetings?
Sure. Basically, all we do is we listen to Robert Bly and Iron John. At any point, if somebody, you know, has an epiphany or something that they choose to share about, or something that actually hits home with them, we stop it and we discuss it. You know, what it means, what that particular extract means for them. Like I was just talking about with that extract that we just listened to about, you know, the role of fathers in society today. That you know, we often only get a father's mood rather than his time.
Sure.
I found a great deal of value in things like Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. You know, it gave me some insight that actually, you know, there were people out there that I could actually validate the fact that when I come home from work, all I want to do for half an hour is crawl into my cave and just process the day. That's how I do things. You know, I don't tend to run around talking about it. I usually come out of the cave after half an hour or so and start talking about it. But it's like, up until then, I just need to be by myself for a little while.
Sure.
And that there's some value in that. It's not a bad thing. Whereas, you know, constantly, I guess, the message that I got a lot of the time from women was that I have to talk about my feelings all the time. And there are times when I just don't want to talk about my feelings. You know, and that's basically what we do, is we just share with each other some of the insights that we get from Robert Bly, and it gives us an opportunity to see things from somebody else's perspective now and again.
Yep.
Like I said, Robert Bly doesn't have all the answers, and I don't pretend that I know everything that he's pertaining to within the structure of what he talks about. Somebody else can provide me with an insight that I may never have seen before.
Sure. Do you find, you are obviously a fairly extroverted sort of a character, obviously the way you're happy to speak about your experiences on this program does set you apart from a lot of men who don't like to talk about, you know, their deep inner feelings. I mean,
sure.
How do you find that the Iron John group meetings bring, you know, these less extroverted men, how does it bring them to the surface and get them talking?
I guess because what we do is it's part of the structure of the group is to make sure that it's safe. So nobody gets criticised for how they're feeling or what's going on or their own insights. We understand that people are at different levels within their growth cycles. You know, people may have a great deal of growth, maybe at a level where I am, where they can openly talk about what they're feeling and what's going on for them. There's other people that can't. And that's okay too. We're not going to actually force them to talk about anything, but hopefully we provide a safe environment for them to do that. The one thing that I would recommend is a few of the guys, there's at least four guys in that group that I've had some contact with over the last 20 years, both short and long term. So I think that's kind of important, is that if you're going to put together a group like this, that you make sure that there's people that you can be comfortable with.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, Athol. Well, look, we might go to another track, and then I've got a fairly lengthy extract that I want to play from Iron John, dealing with warriors.
Yep.
And if we can get you back on after that, that would be great.
Sure, no problem, mate.
Thanks, Athol. We'll be back in a moment.
Don't rock the boat, keep your head down, just another watching the world go by. Make love in the middle of a war zone, all of God's children. Never gonna die. It will be done to the scene of the crime when the river runs dry. Salvation will riddle you one more time when the river runs dry. You will return to the scene of the crime when the river runs dry. Salvation will riddle you one more time when the river runs
grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
So it's time now for the warrior. It's time in the development of a man for the warrior to come in. Michael Mead reminds us of the old Celtic motto, never give a sword to a man who can't dance. Our story says that the next step for the boy is warriorhood after the garden, not before it. The warriors inside American men have become weak in recent years, and their weakness contributes to a lack of boundaries, a condition which earlier we spoke of as naivete. A grown man 6 foot tall will allow another person to cross his boundaries, enter his psychic house, verbally abuse him, carry away his treasures, and then slam the door behind. And the invaded man will stand there with an ingratiating, confused smile on his face. When a boy grows up in a dysfunctional family, perhaps there is no other kind of family, his interior warriors will be killed off early. Warriors mythologically lift their swords to defend the king. The king in a child stands up for and stands for the child's mood. But when we are children, our mood gets easily overrun and swept over in the messed up family by the more powerful, more dominant, more terrifying mood of the parent. We can say that when the warriors inside cannot protect our mood at 3 years old from being disintegrated or defend our body from invasion, the warriors collapse, go into a trance, or die. Each child lives deep inside his or her own psychic house, or soul castle, and the child deserves the right of sovereignty inside that house. Whenever a parent ignores the child's sovereignty and invades, the child feels not only anger, but shame. The child concludes that if it has no sovereignty, it must be worthless. Shame is the name that we give to the sense that we are unworthy and inadequate as human beings. When our parents do not respect our territory at all, their disrespect seems overwhelming proof of our inadequacy. A slap across the face pierces deeply, for the face is the actual boundary of our souls, and we have been penetrated. If a grown-up decides to cross our sexual boundaries and touch us, there's nothing that we as children can do about it. Our warriors die. The child, so full of expectation or blessing, whenever he or she is around an adult, stiffens with shock and falls into the timeless, fossilized confusion of shame. What is worse, one sexual invasion or one beating usually leads to another, and the warriors, if revived, die again. I think it's likely that the early death of a man's warriors keeps the boy in him from growing up. It's possible that it also prevents the female in the boy from developing. We know that Dickens, for example, endured a horrendous childhood, and we also notice that his female characters tend to be sentimental and girlish. It's possible that these girlish beings are projections of his stunted interior woman, whom his warriors could not protect from the violence all around him. The inner boy in a messed up family may keep on being shamed, invaded, disappointed, and paralyzed for years and years. I am a victim, he says, over and over, and he is. But that very identification with victimhood keeps the soul house open and available for still more invasions. Most American men today do not have enough awakened or living warriors inside to defend their soul houses. Women cannot defend their soul houses either. Most people do not know what genuine outward or inward warriors would look like or feel like. Psychologist and theologian Robert Moore has thought cogently and intensely about the warrior, and we'll sum up a few of his ideas about the outward or disciplined warrior. He emphasizes that for men, the energy of the warrior is hardwired. It is not software. He may say to men, "You have plenty of warrior in you. Don't worry about it. More than you'll need. The question is whether you will honor it, whether you will have it consciously or unconsciously." The warrior's area of expertise and experience is the battlefield. The war that takes place there can be physical war, psychological war, or spiritual war. Inside that reverberating and ritual space, armies, tribes, divinities, even ideas arrange themselves in adversarial fashion. Flags go up, voices deepen, brains sharpen, urgency tightens muscles. Extroverted men in the warrior mode, like General Patton, imagine battle, steel on steel, the holiness of the battlefield. As holy to them as the black-seeded field is to the farmer. They imagine that rushing in of adrenaline, personal combat, the delight of danger, even the joy of noble death. Moore emphasizes that the quality of a true warrior is that he's in service to a purpose greater than himself, that is, to a transcendental cause. Mythologically, he's in service to a true king. If the king he serves is corrupt, as in Ollie North's case, or if there's no king at all, and he is serving greed or power, then he's no longer a warrior, but a soldier. When a warrior is in service, however, to a true king, that is, to a transcendent cause, he does well and his body becomes a hard-working servant, which he requires to endure cold, heat, pain, wounds, scarring, hunger, lack of sleep, hardship of all kinds. The person in touch with warrior energy can work long hours, ignore fatigue, do what is necessary, finish the Ph.D. and all the footnotes, endure obnoxious department heads, live sparsely like Ralph Nader, write as T.S. Eliot did under a single dangling light bulb for years, clean up shit and filth endlessly like St. Francis or Mother Teresa, endure contempt, disdain, and exile as Sakharov did. We need to mention as well the sacred or holy warrior who lives in eternal space. The field for him, for the holy warrior, is the field of good and evil. Ancient literature, such as the Ramayana or Mahabharata, carries many more descriptions of these impalpable, invisible battles than of the battlefields in which human beings live and die. How can any complicated culture live without strong warrior energy? The outward warriors inside some women are today strong, sometimes stronger than those in men. Forces in contemporary society recently have encouraged women to be warriors while discouraging warriorhood in boys and men. We could say that the sacred warrior disappeared in our culture and the personal warrior as well. At Ypres in 1915, 100,000 young men died in one day, all of whom died without seeing the machine gunners who killed them. Anything left of the warrior vanished with the mass bombings of Dresden, the bombs on Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and the B-52 bombings of rice fields in Vietnam. Contemporary war, with its mechanical and heartless destruction, has made the heat of aggression seem disgraceful. The Vietnam veterans suffered soul damage in that they went into battle imagining they served a warrior god and came back out of it godless. We can all add further details of the decline from warrior to soldier to murderer, but it's important to notice the result. The disciplined warrior, made irrelevant by mechanized war, disdained and abandoned by the high-tech culture, is fading in American men. And the fading of the warrior contributes to the collapse of civilized society. A man who cannot defend his own space cannot defend women or children. The poisoned warriors, called drug lords, prey primarily for recruits on kingless, warriorless boys. If a culture does not deal with the warrior energy, take it in consciously, discipline it, honor it, it will turn up outside in the form of street gangs, wife-beating, brutality to children, and aimless murder. And it all moves so swiftly. The massive butcheries of 1915 finish off the disciplined or outward warrior, and then within 30 years, the warrior's inside Western men begin to weaken. The double weakening makes us realize how connected the outer and the inner world are, how serious the events of history are. Warriorhood is associated with the god Mars, and Mars with iron. Men now experience a shortage of iron. Men now do not know how to retrieve and revive their inner warriors. Oftentimes, that goes back to early childhood. A boy at 5, for example, may put one hand on his mother's heart and the other on the earth and conduct her pain down to the ground. Or he may conduct his father's rage to the ground. Many of us lived as copper conductors of intense emotions of our parents. We lived as copper conductors, not as boys. Such a man will then look, when adult, for a woman whose pain he can continue to conduct to the earth. So we can say that men now have too much copper and not enough iron. This is another way to refer to the shortage of the interior warrior. So it was Iron John's purpose in the last warrior section to help the boy develop more iron. It's the job of the older men to do the work of initiation. We know that our society produces a plentiful supply of boys, but seems to produce fewer and fewer men. Some contemporary cultures, the New Guinea tribes would be examples, who are warrior cultures, force the boys to be men through various cunning, heated, imaginative, reckless austerities and teachings that may happen too quickly to produce a solid man. We come in at the opposite end of the spectrum in that we have no ideas at all on how to produce men, and we let it all happen unconsciously while we look away to Wall Street and hope for the best. Michael Ventura, in a magnificent essay called The Age of Endarkenment, published recently in the Whole Earth Review, speaks of adolescent wildness and its challenge to our lack of ideas. Their music, their fashions, their words, their codes, he says, announce that the initiatory moment has come. Those extravagances are a request for a response, Ventura remarks. Tribal people everywhere greeted the onset of puberty, especially in males, with elaborate and excruciating initiations, a practice that plainly wouldn't have been necessary unless their young men were as extreme as ours. The tribal adults didn't run from this moment in their children as we do. They celebrated it. They would assault their adolescents with quite literally holy terror, rituals that had been kept secret from the young until that moment. Rituals that focused upon the young all the light and darkness of their tribe's collective psyche, all its sense of mystery, all its questions, and all the stories told to both harbor and answer those questions. The crucial word here is focus. The adult had something to teach. Stories, skills, magic, dances, visions, rituals. In fact, if these things were not learned well and completely, the tribe could not survive. Tribal culture satisfied the craving while supplying the need, and we call that initiation. This practice was so effective that usually by the age of 15, a tribal youth was able to take his or her place as a fully responsible adult. Ventura notices that for about 40 years, the young in our culture have generated forms, music, fashions, behaviors, quote, that prolong the initiatory moment, as though hoping to be somehow initiated by chance somewhere along the way, unquote. It doesn't happen. Mick Jagger gets middle-aged, and still the adults offer no response to the opening. There are many sorts of initiation, many models, and many sequences of rituals and teachings. We have to recognize that all sequences of initiatory stages are linear, that we know of, and initiation itself resembles a sphere. So, with that warning, we could look now at a linear view of male initiation, which I'll lay out in 5 stages. The first stage would be bonding with the mother and separation from the mother.
We do the first stage moderately well, and the second not well at all, particularly in the suburbs and the ghettos. Second stage, bonding with the father and separation from the father. We often postpone the father bonding until we're 50 or so, and then separation still has to be done. Third, the arrival of the male mother or the mentor, the man who helps the man rebuild the bridge to his own greatness or essence. King Arthur is an example of such a male mother. With us, this step happens haphazardly, if at all. And fourth, apprenticeship to some hurricane energy, such as the wild man or the warrior or Dionysus. When the young man has done that apprenticeship well, he receives a drink from the waters of the god. Such a drink is one thing the adolescents are asking for. And the fifth stage of initiation that we'll mention then is marriage with the holy woman or with the queen. The events of our story fit roughly into this model of classic initiation. Iron John represents the adult mentor who reconnects the boy to his greatness in the spring section and to his gold head. Iron John, as the wild man, is also himself the divine energy from whose waters the boy is allowed to drink. The lack of initiation in contemporary culture means that the boy receives no help in his very first task of initiation, namely separation from the mother. Our culture has paid attention in recent years, and rightly so, to men's physical incest with their daughters, which is hideous and revolting in its range and damage. And we have paid some attention to psychic incest as well between father and daughter. But the culture still does not take very seriously the damage caused by psychic incest between mother and son. 20 to 30% of boys now live in houses with no adult man present. But psychic incest is by no means restricted to single-parent homes. The emphasis placed in recent decades on the inadequacy of men and on the evil of the patriarchal system encourages mothers to discount grown men. Contemporary women have also become aware of their own rich interior lives. A 20th century woman feels complicated sensibilities in herself that no ordinary or mortal man can meet. I am suggesting, then, that two contemporary trends have come together. One is the increasing emphasis in the American culture on the adult man's inadequacy, even his absurdity, and the second is the woman's increased awareness of her own interior emotional richness. When these two trends come together, hope for change and fulfillment falls on young sons. The mother looks to the son for emotional satisfaction, and her fantasies in that regard may have deepened in recent years. It's not uncommon for grown men to turn to young women for sexual companionship. A grown woman may turn to her 8-year-old son for soul companionship. Her fantasies could include dreams that he'll redeem the crudities of other men, that he'll develop a mind open to women's values, and that she will have a soul companion in him. Perhaps, in her fantasies, he will live out some heroic scenario that she could not. Above all, she hopes that he may learn to be kind to women, kinder than his father was, and will be able to satisfy his own woman sexually. In short, she will hope that he'll become a better lover to his woman than his father was or is. Who could his woman be?
Okay, well, that was Robert Bly, and we're back with Athol. Would you like to tell us a bit more about the mechanics of the Iron John group that you are involved in?
Sure. Just quickly before I do, I'm actually standing here with a smile on my face just listening to that last bit, because I can always remember the most scathing thing that I ever heard as a child was, "You're just like your father."
I think we've all heard that many times, yeah.
Yes, and, you know, the damage that's incurred by that, I don't think even women actually get. Do you know what I mean? They don't understand that the kind of damage that they're doing to their own sons, which is quite sad.
Yeah, it is, mate. It's just an off-the-cuff remark, but they don't really understand the emotional thing behind it.
Yes, and that's a part of what I've gotten out of all this work, is the understanding of the emotional stuff that goes behind some of the things that I want to want to spit out of my mouth, which leaves me with the point where I can actually not spit it out my mouth and think about it before I spit it out my mouth.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which I think is really, really important. I guess the mechanics of the group are fairly simple. It's just a matter of getting together and talking about this stuff, relating to each other on you know, like any group, you just relate to each other on different levels. You know, we've got a wide range of people in that group, from a single father battling the courts at the moment to get some access to his daughter, to myself, who's single and never married and no kids, you know, to people that are divorced and people that are in relationships, people that are Christians, people that are like myself and atheists. You know, it's just it's pretty much wide ranging, and basically all we do is get together and talk about this stuff.
Nathal, could you? Oh, you've touched on it a few minutes ago, but I wonder if you could tell us, perhaps in a little bit more detail, how you've benefited from these meetings.
One of the things was what Robert Bly was talking about valuing the warrior energy, and I think a lot of the time that in the society that we live in, men and even women actually can see the value of that warrior energy, and you can hear it. They know it intuitively. It's like you'll go to somebody and say, what do you do for a living? And the first thing he says is, I'm a corporate warrior. And he understands that that energy is valuable and it's necessary. It's just that it's being channeled really, really poorly, to the point where we are actually damaging whole generations of men. You know, Robert Bly talks a lot about Vietnam, which was probably his generation. Our generation, or the generation after mine, is now dealing with another war that they cannot win, but they're still throwing bodies at it. You know, my generation, when I was 23 or 25, 26 in 91, you know, we were over there again. So it's like we're continuing to throw men at war, without any understanding of what it actually does to them. And then, more importantly, without any help afterwards. It's like they come back in country and it's like they're left to their own devices. And I heard an ad this morning on your radio show about counselling service, I think, for returned servicemen, which I think is just a great thing. You know, the guys who came back from Vietnam never really had those things. So I think it's good that we can actually see that we need to treat these problems post what we do to these boys, you know?
Nathal, is the benefit, do you think, from unburdening yourself in a group situation, is that where the benefit comes, or is it from instruction, or what?
I think it's a bit of both. I mean, now I'm kind of, you know, 20 years down the track, I'm 43, and I feel that I can actually have some self-instruction around this stuff. But on the same token, you know, Robert Bly touched on it there, there's that mentality a lot of the time that a lot of men have, in that my way and the things that I want to do are the only things that have value. And what I can actually see after doing this work is that I don't have all the answers. So I benefit from being open and listening to other people and other men. And, you know, he talked about mentorship. You know, I had some of that at, you know, the tender age of 21. So I got the value of actually that there are people in this world who know more than me. And sometimes I need to actually listen. You know, there's a reason that I was born with two ears, two eyes, and only one mouth. You know, so I get a lot of that out of that group, is that, you know, that there are people that have different experiences, and my experience, you know, I've learned from young people who have learned from other people. So I've been able to learn from people indirectly, because I've been open to the fact that they can actually, you know, whether they're young, old, middle-aged, you know, or in between, they have some value in some of the stuff in their own experiences.
And for our listeners who would like to participate, what's the best way they could get involved with Iron John?
Okay, at the moment we're actually a closed group. We've got there's 8 people there, and that's quite enough. But certainly, if they want some assistance or some help in starting up an Iron John group, you know, I'm open to. They can ring your station and get my number off you guys. Ian's got my number, so I'm quite happy for you guys to pass it on. Some of the guidelines that we have is, you know, we actually meet in a neutral place, so we rent a small hall that's attached to a church, so that it's a neutral venue. You know, you can do it at home if you want to. We just decided not to do that because it kind of gives, you know, it can sometimes cause some uncomfortability for other people to come into somebody else's home to do this stuff. At least now we know in the hall that it's all private. You know, nobody's going to come and interrupt us. We're not going to get interrupted by wives and children. It's our 2 hours together. But yeah, certainly if people want to try and get some heads up about how to start one, I'm happy to talk to them.
And are there a number of these groups around Sydney?
Mine's the only one I know of.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, even if there are other Ryan John groups, I'd like to hear about it.
And what about around Australia, or is it only in Sydney at the moment?
Well, like I said, mine's the only group that I know of, but I know that there are, you know, people that I've actually been doing some of this work with who live interstate, and they probably work their own groups or maybe even talk about their own stuff with in other situations. Like I said, it's not like there's an organisation here. It's kind of really left up to us to do it on our own. So, yeah, it's not like, an organised group as such.
And how often do you meet?
We meet once a week.
For a couple of hours?
For about 2 hours. And, you know, some nights we might get through 2 minutes of listening to Robert Bly and then we're talking all night.
Yeah,
other nights we'll get through,
yep,
you know, half an hour and then talk about it, you know.
Yep, absolutely.
So, and we've got no real time frame as to how many weeks that we can go, or, you know, okay, it's just a matter of just getting through it and working through it and talking about it and, again, relating to each other around it.
Yep, so it's not like a program thing where you've got to go from week one through to week eight and then, you know, you're done?
Definitely not.
Okay,
Definitely not.
It's more or less just a drop-in thing, but as you said, your numbers are full in your particular group?
Yeah, at the moment, yes.
Yep.
But, again, like, that's because we decided to, after about week three, to close off the group. The reason being that once you actually start, because a lot of the stuff that we're talking about is fairly intimate stuff, as I'm sure that you're aware. So
yep,
it's kind of like after about 3 weeks, you're kind of getting comfortable with people, and to introduce other people into it then becomes a bit of an issue because it changes the dynamic of the group again.
Yeah, in some sense you're taking a step backwards.
Yes. So, but yeah, like I said, you know, if people find that they've got, you know, five or six of their friends that are interested in this stuff and they'd like to start a group, I'm happy to talk to them and see if they can, you know, to give them some assistance to get it up and running.
Well, thanks, Athol. That's been great, mate. I mean, thanks for coming on the show. We're actually running out of time now, so...
Pleasure.
Yeah, once again, that was very thoughtful and inspirational stuff. Thanks for coming on.
No worries. Thank you for having me, guys.
You're welcome. Thanks, mate.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Empty house, empty life, no family, no wife. I can stay up all night, I can run around in the nude, I can eat steak or any other type of food. I don't have to go and buy her flowers. Don't have to be early, I don't have to be late. I'm Daddy Immaculate. I'm Daddy Immaculate. Come to a honey, yo. Daddy Immaculate, coming to a Panayo.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
our obligation, and I include in our, all the women and men writing about gender, is to describe masculine in such a way that it does not exclude the masculine in women, and yet hits a resonant string in the man's heart. No one says there aren't resonating strings in a woman's heart, too, but in the man's heart there's a low string that makes his whole chest tremble when the qualities of the masculine are spoken of in the right way. Our obligation is to describe the feminine in a way that does not exclude the feminine in men, but makes a large string resonate in the woman's heart. Some string in the man's heart will resonate as well, but I suspect that in the woman's heart there is a low string that makes her whole chest tremble when the qualities of the feminine are spoken of in the right way. At the same time, we all know that there are in reality, besides these two states, feminine and masculine, all sorts of degrees, intermediate states, unions, combinations, special cases, genius, exceptions, and so on. For the time being, it is the men and women who are passed through the grief door into their own childhood to whom the story we've retold will speak best. They will be able to use the story and others like it, blessedly preserved by the memory culture that our ancestors lived in up until the time of writing.
We're dead on the air. We're dead.